Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk. Managing pollution responsibly costs money, but there is no place in our system of accounting that requires the producers of that pollution to pay the costs of managing it responsibly. This means that government intervention in the economy is necessary. In 2021, the Washington State Legislature passed and Governor Inslee signed the Climate Commitment Act, or CCA. The policy is also known as Cap and Invest. We're going to be talking today with Altanai Karasipan, who is Washington Regulatory Policy Manager at Climate Solutions. She closely follows what's going on with that bill and what it portends for our fossil fuel emissions future. Altanai Karasipan of Climate Solutions, welcome to Climate Talk.
Thanks for having me, John. Very excited to chat with you.
Yep. Well, I'm equally excited. We're talking about what I think is, especially for, let's say, a layperson who is interested in where we're headed in the state of Washington here, of getting your thoughts on the Climate Commitment Act, a unique Washington law right now. There are other laws that are similar, of course, but I think this is somewhat of a leading edge effort on the state of Washington. Now, you're the regulatory policy manager at Climate Solutions. So tell us a bit about how you ended up at Climate Solutions and what's it like working there?
Sure. So my background is completely in environmental and clean energy policy. So it was a really solid fit for me, but I am originally from the DC area. So I, after, you know, getting my undergrad degree, went to back home to DC and worked at a few different nonprofits, particularly focused on, you know, state policy and state advocacy, especially at a time during the Trump administration. It was really nice to be able to work on state policy. And that really inspired me to keep working at this level. And I moved over to Seattle for various reasons and got my master's and eventually found my way to Climate Solutions, working on kind of the implementation of all of these clean energy laws that we've passed. It's really exciting to be working in Washington. We have one of the, I think, best frameworks to really tackle climate change. And it's really amazing to be able to work to implement these kind of landmark policies. So lucky to work at Climate Solutions.
Yeah. So you mentioned what we sometimes politely refer to as the other Washington.
Yeah.
So which triggers a question for me. And that is, you know, sometimes those of us who are concerned about the environment, there's this kind of thing like, do we look to the federal government or do we look to state governments for whatever problems are? And of course, we see this with a lot of other issues that are of concern all over the United States. So what are your thoughts on the relationship between us focusing energy on federal legislation versus doing things within a state like we are out here in Washington right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so incredibly important to keep working at the state level. I think there a lot of advocates talk about when Barack Obama became president, you saw kind of a drop in funding and focus in state policy because there was so much hope around federal policy. Obviously, Congress has a lot of issues to work through and tons of bottlenecks there. So it is obviously a huge challenge to pass anything at the federal level. So I think we, you know, saw that in that time that state policy, especially when we were then under President Trump's administration, the importance of state policy and kind of keeping things moving, making progress happen. And that being said, we did see the passage of the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the IIJA, which is the infrastructure, essentially the infrastructure bill. And I think those showed that federal policymaking is still possible and can be incredibly transformational. But we also still need those state policies to be working and strong so we can funnel those federal funds into the right programs and effective programs at the state level. So I think both are important, but keeping momentum at the state level is really critical.
Yeah, well, that's words of encouragement for advocates who we are here. We can meet with elected representatives in a way that we can't really with in the federal government. And there are hearings and so on that are local or local enough that we can participate with. So, you know, the short answer to the question I posed there was all of the above. You know, we work where it's possible with the federal government, and we do the same thing in a state and local government. And of course, all of those things take energy. And I think we can be assured that in both cases, that if we're not putting our energy out there, that's the wrong answer in itself. So let's just jump into the Climate Commitment Act. So little acronym for you. You're I made reference to acronyms, the CCA. So Climate Commitment Act. So could you tell us a little bit of the history of the Climate Commitment Act, what it's intended to accomplish? And then as we do that, then we'll kind of like ask you to break it down a little bit in terms of how are we doing? Is it meeting expectations? And what can we imagine the effect of it is going to be over time? So first of all, just what exactly is the Climate Commitment Act?
Sure. Really, in broad strokes, the Climate Commitment Act, I think, has three main purposes. The first is to reduce emissions by establishing a cap on our emissions statewide and gradually shrinking that cap over time to get them to 0%. The next purpose is to protect community health through new air quality protections and programs. And I would say the final and really critical purpose of the CCA is to make polluters finally pay for the pollution that they create.
So how long has this bill been around? It's relatively recent, I think.
Yeah, so the CCA passed in 2021 and officially became state law this year. So we are just kind of, I think the analogy is building the plane as we're flying it. Mm-hmm. We are just now starting to see kind of its benefits and its impacts in real time. And kind of at the foundation of the Climate Commitment Act, when we talk about how it works, is its cap and invest program, which, as its name would suggest, works by capping emissions and reducing them at a fairly rapid rate to meet those 2050 goals. So that's a 95% reduction requirement by 2050. And the enforcement mechanism of that cap are these pollution permits or allowances, where businesses actually have to purchase or acquire allowances for every single metric ton of emissions that they pollute. So it's with this sale of these permits that we are generating revenue that will enable the state to invest in climate change at really an unprecedented scale. We're about to see billions of dollars come to the state for climate policies and climate programs specifically. So it's a really pivotal moment in Washington's climate policy landscape.
So what are some of those projects, for lack of a better term, that those funds are going to be put towards that we can expect to benefit communities and the environment in general?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think looking to our state budget this past year is a really great kind of window into what these investments will look like. Some of the ones we at Climate Solutions are really excited about are one, we're getting $150 million, $15 million in electrifying our homes and buildings through a new grant program that will ensure all households in the state can afford the entire cost of a heat pump, of electric appliances, other efficiency upgrades. You know, cleaning up our homes, our buildings, and sources of heating and cooling are so critical, especially as we are now in, you know, the midst of a smoke event in Washington, and wildfires are unfortunately only expected to get worse. So having a safe, healthy indoor space and home is so critical now more than ever. So these funds will help us get there. Another program we're really excited about it's multiple programs, but we're seeing over $250 million in investments for clean, medium and heavy duty vehicles. So these are the trucks, buses, delivery vans, school buses that drive all through our communities and do offer really critical services, but also come with really high levels of pollution. So for some context, although pollution from single passenger vehicles has kind of leveled off in recent years, pollution from diesel engines have more than doubled since 1990. And these trucks not only have, you know, a major climate, global greenhouse gas emissions impact, but they have a real impact on our health and our local air quality. And, you know, when you think about the fact that many roadways concentrate around and in low-income and BIPOC communities, this is a huge equity issue as well. So we have now $250 million to kind of jumpstart that process of cleaning up this really heavy polluting sector. So, and I mean, I really could go on about the number of projects and exciting things coming to Washington from CCA funds. I think there's investments in natural, our natural environment, because nature-based solutions to climate and resilience are really critical, and investments in to protect critical species like salmon. There are investments that will fund a new tribal clean energy grant program. I mean, really, the list goes on. So happy to keep talking about it, or we can take a pause there.
Yeah, well, I get your excitement, and it is amazing to think of the amount of funds that are in the pipeline, or we can expect to be in the pipeline. And it sounds like those funds are going to be there without the, let's say, the annual hassle down in Olympia of establishing a budget. So one of the things I'm wondering about, a lot of money, who is the final say in how it's spent, or who administers the spending of these monies?
Yeah. So the budget is written by the legislature. Ultimately, though, the administration of these dollars will be through our different agencies. So the Department of Commerce will house a ton of these new grant programs. The Department of Ecology will as well. I think there are programs through Fish and Wildlife, through natural resources. But I think Commerce and Ecology hold a lot of the you know, carbon emissions reduction specific kind of technology side of things. And they are actively trying to staff up. It's, as you can imagine, with all this money coming in, there's a lot of work they have to do to basically have the capacity to administer all of these new programs, but they're actively doing it to basically ensure we can get this money out the door as quick as possible and get to our communities, because this is really, crunch time to getting it into our hands. So
I'm just wondering how secure this, for lack of a better term, to call a pipeline of funds downstream is. And the thing that I'm wondering about is I'm seeing pushback in the media. There's been articles in the Seattle Times, for instance, people complaining about the price of gasoline. And Washington State, I've heard, said that Washington State's got the most expensive gasoline in the United States. Detractors of the CCA are pointing to the CCA and saying, okay, this is why gasoline costs so much. So are consumers all up and down the line, are they the ones that are going to be bearing the cost of these funds that the CCA gathers?
That's a really great question and a really complex question. Okay. And I will do my best to answer it. But I think, you know, it is hard to know whether and to what degree businesses will pass off the cost of complying with this new law. And this is especially challenging in the case of gas prices, where the different factors that go into the cost of gas are really intentionally opaque. While gas companies definitely want you to believe that climate policies are the single cause of these price hikes, the reality is that the driving force behind gas prices is oil companies' profit margins. Mm-hmm. Last year, when we were seeing high gas prices all across the nation, oil companies raked in actually record profits. And in Washington, gas prices are associated with some of the highest profit margins in the country. So, for an example, December 2022, retail gas profit margins were at about 86 cents per gallon in Washington, as compared to states like Alabama, Texas, and South Carolina, where profit margins were actually less than 10 cents per gallon. So you can see that, and really this isn't new news. Oil industries are kind of known for price gouging behavior, and they are price setters. So while oil companies might pass on some of the cost of the CCA to customers through gas prices, I think we don't actually have clarity on the different factors influencing these costs. And that's actually why California passed a new gas prices price gouging legislation last session that just went into law. And that law aims to combat price gouging at the pump, basically by requiring transparency around imports, profit margins, maintenance impacts, those sorts of things. So this is a known problem around price gouging. And I think as consumers, we need to kind of hold gas companies or oil companies accountable for this, their actions.
Yeah. So you used a term a little earlier that I think is an important one: polluters pay. And so there certainly is what I almost call poetic justice in the idea that the petroleum industry and related, or let's say fossil fuel energy industries, have gotten away with over a century worth of dumping their pollutants into the environment and other people bearing the cost of those through health and degraded environment to live in and so on. So it really does seem, in a way, I mean, and I worry sometimes the petroleum industry almost seems like a law unto itself, just like you sketched out there. You know, it seems like they pretty much raise prices at will, and then they're always blaming somebody else. But isn't there some justice in the fact that they should be paying to clean up some of this mess that they've been integral to creating in the first place?
Absolutely. I think, yeah, you said it really well, but we have been subsidizing the cost of gas for, you know, so long, the cost of fossil fuels for so long, and it's really time for them to take on those costs that they have been externalizing all this time. So costs to our health, costs to our longevity, all of these things, costs to our environment. And it is time to like really put a price on those emissions. So the price of an allowance is an important one to kind of set that standard and stop subsidizing these companies.
Yeah, and of course, I wonder if you think by you, I'm talking about Climate Solutions and similar, think about the fact that it's pretty clear that when the price of something goes up, people buy less of it. So is this a consideration also in this cap and invest idea that as fossil fuels could be expected to become more expensive, people will use less of them and turn to greener alternatives?
Certainly, that is, you know, the way the allowances are set up is that over time there will be fewer and fewer allowances available for businesses to purchase, and that is because it's supposed to decline along with the cap and encourage fewer emissions. And that number of allowances is going to shrink pretty rapidly, and kind of correspondingly, as you mentioned, you know, supply and demand, the demand will continue to rise for those allowances. But I think it's also important to remember when we're thinking about the compliance cost of the law, the point of the program is to stop businesses from polluting and reduce their emissions. The goal isn't to have polluters continue to buy allowances and keep emitting. So over time, ideally, it will become cheaper for them to switch to clean energy rather than to pay for a super expensive allowance. And I think we are also, by investing in all of these climate and clean energy programs, like the medium and heavy duty electrification program, like the heat pump program, we are also trying to switch the equation around our own personal investments and choices in climate and clean energy. We're trying to make it as affordable as possible for everyone to make the transition. So I think the design of the program really is to make it not only make it more expensive to pollute, but also to make it cheaper to switch to those cleaner options.
Yeah, well, I know that economists for a long time have been saying that that is probably the one of the most effective ways of reducing our emissions. So you made the point, I believe, that over time the allowances are going to shrink, the number of allowances that can be purchased. And those allowances, the way I understand it, are going to be purchased in a market of allowances. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so they the way it's set up is they have 4 auctions per year, and essentially businesses submit their own bids for a certain number of allowances at a certain price. And those are state-run auctions, but these businesses don't have access to any other bids or know what other costs or prices other businesses are putting to those allowances. So the businesses themselves are setting the price of an allowance through that process. So the state will collect all those bids, and then the lowest bid that's accepted, so the lowest price per number of per allowance, will be the price of an allowance throughout the market for that auction, if that makes some sense.
So every business then will be paying the same price for an allowance as every other business?
Yes, correct.
So would it be reasonable to think that as the number of allowances offered shrinks, that the price is going to get higher and higher over time?
Yes, I think that's reasonable to assume. But hopefully, there will be fewer allowances, meaning their businesses will be forced to switch basically to cleaner sources of energy. And therefore, I think the price impact will come out differently in the future, when it'll be ultimately cheaper to switch to clean energy sources rather than paying for more emissions and allowance permits, if that sounds logical.
It does sound logical. So I'm going to ask you, as a person who follows this closely, just what your personal perception is. I mean, are you optimistic that this law is going to accomplish its purpose over time, with, let's say, minimum impact on people's cost of living?
I am very hopeful personally. I think, we had 2 auctions this year, and in those 2 auctions alone, we were very successful. They both demonstrated a really strong demand for these pollution permits. And we generated over $850 million in those first 2 auctions alone. And I think, for context, the legislature estimated that we would have about $2 billion from the CCA in the next 2 years to invest in climate. And after the first 2 auctions alone, we're nearly halfway there, despite having about 8 more auctions to generate revenue for the next biennium. So we are expecting significantly more funds available to us to invest in clean energy solutions than we initially expected. And I think that is a huge success, and something that will hopefully carry this program into the future, because we will soon start to see the impacts of those dollars as soon as those programs are kind of up and running.
Yeah, listening to you say that, one of the things I'm hoping for is that the state does a good job of communicating with the public and say, mm-hmm. okay, these funds are coming in and this is what we're doing with them. These are how your communities, your homes are benefiting from them. What's your sense of how good the state is going to be at doing that?
Yeah, I agree that that is a major challenge. And it's not only like getting that information out there, but finding the right channels to put it through to really reach communities across Washington. One bill that was introduced last year that did not pass, but I think has a pathway this year, is a bill introduced by Representative Rammel, a navigator bill. And essentially what that would do is as it was in this previous bill, it would lay out all of the potential options that consumers have available to them to, purchase a heat pump or get home energy retrofits or home upgrades or home retrofits to, and they would be able to see, okay, if I want to get a heat pump, I have access to this federal program, or I have access to these state dollars, and I can leverage them in this way to be able to maximize the amount of impact those dollars will have. And I think having some sort of program that helps consumers walk through what's available to them and how to access them is really critical, and hopefully a gap that new legislation can fill.
Anything else that you can think of that we should be paying attention to or be concerned about in the next legislature session?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the most important thing we can do over the next session and really the next decade is to make sure that these new CCA dollars are invested wisely, and to make sure that these programs and clean energy solutions are accessible to everyone. So advocating for the programs we want to see that can really make a difference in not only Washington's emissions, but our air quality, our livelihoods, our access to, you know, all of these amazing solutions. I think that is one of the biggest things. So really thinking about the budget strategically is critical. Another piece of legislation that is likely to come down the pipeline is price gouging legislation that we saw and that I mentioned earlier in California, to basically ensure transparency around oil prices. I think it's just critical to make sure the oil industry isn't getting away with illegal price gouging, and this legislation is one way to tackle that. And then the Navigator bill, as we mentioned, hopefully something in either its previous form or new form will come up. But it's, you know, as we talked about, a real challenge to make sure with all this money coming in that communities know where to even begin, whether it's federal money, state money, or local funds, finding a way to kind of centralize all of that information and make it accessible to all of us is really critical.
Yeah, so really some really important issues there. And this program will be taking a closer look as the legislative session gets closer, so that we can be informed citizens when we talk to our elected representatives about our concerns and in the way that you kind of outline them. So a little bit change of direction here. One of the things I'm wondering about is legal challenges. Are there any legal challenges to the CCA in the offing, or are you concerned at all, or should we be concerned about legal challenges to this bill?
This is one question that I don't have a ton of insight into.
Okay.
But I will just say that opposition is always going to exist, but we are going to do our best. But maybe this is one we can skip.
Yeah, sure. No worries. So then we're getting close to the end of wrapping up here. So could you give us a wrap up of what this bill is intended to do, and kind of summarize the benefits to individual homes, households, health benefits, and those kind of things? Give us
sure
a rundown
thing
on that for kind of a wrap up here.
Okay. So as I mentioned, the Climate Commitment Act is really designed to not only reduce our emissions and make polluters pay, but it's to bring benefits to our communities and to protect community health. There were, I think, a critical part of the bill that I haven't yet spoken about are the air protections that are written into the law. So there's a whole section in the law dedicated to reducing criteria air pollutants in overburdened communities. And I think that just speaks to the fact that this bill really tries to not only tackle our greenhouse gas emissions, but get at the core of a lot of our local air pollutions that have a ton of equity implications associated with them. And our investments, I think, are a really important way that we're going to do that. We have a 35% minimum that's required to directly benefit overburdened communities overburdened by climate impacts, air pollution, socioeconomic factors, all of these things. And I think that plus a 10% investment minimum required for tribes, it really, these funds have the potential to really transform our landscape in Washington and what each of our communities look like. And Ideally, you know, in the future, thanks to the CCA, we'll have cleaner air, we'll have healthier homes, we'll have new investments in conservation and our ecosystem services. And this is all thanks to this new program. So it's something to be really excited by, and really encourage folks to keep their eyes out for these new programs that are coming your way. We'll do our best to communicate them out to fellow Washingtonians, but, you know, keep an eye out, and we'll try and keep everybody up to date on what's to come.
Yeah. Thanks for your, not only your enthusiasm, but all the work that you and the folks at Climate Solutions do, because this entire field can be confusing, even overwhelming to the layperson trying to sort their way through. And folks like you can help to sort it out for us. So we really appreciate that. I get, and I love the enthusiasm, just because it's so easy to be, let's say, non-enthusiastic about so much of what we see politically and about the environment. And so I appreciate the optimism that you're bringing. And I guess I will toss in, this optimism comes not from just having a cheerful attitude. It comes from doing a lot of work. And I think that's what we all need to be doing, is using our energy to get things done, pay attention, be informed. And it's what I've heard called active optimism. So I'll just finish up by saying, Altanai Karasapan, thank you so much to you individually and to Climate Solutions for all you do. We'll put a link to Climate Solutions in the show notes and some other items that have come up in the conversation. So, and thank you so much for talking to Climate Talk today.
Thanks so much, John. It's been really fun talking to you, and happy to come back to the show and in the future to talk more about the impacts of the Climate Commitment Act.
Well, that's an offer I can't refuse. And so I will certainly look forward to doing that, especially later on in the year. We've got a little more track record for the CCA, and then looking into the next legislative session. So we can definitely look forward to it. So once again, thanks so much for joining me today. I learned a lot, and I know our listeners did too.
Thanks, John.
Many thanks to Altanai Karasapan for helping us to understand the Climate Commitment Act. This law has the potential for fostering a healthier environment here in Washington State, as well as being an example and a proving ground for others to learn from. At the same time, anti-science, anti-environmental forces will be out complaining about the bill. The best way to understand and put in their proper place these complaints is for each of us to understand the science of fossil fuel emissions and to understand how the Climate Commitment Act is playing out in our beautiful state. One great way to stay informed is by visiting the Climate Solutions webpage, where they do regular updates on the CCA, as well as updating other aspects of the politics and science of caring for our environment right here at home in Washington State. Understanding how we as individuals can benefit from the CCA can be confusing, and from a consumer perspective, the benefits can and do fly below the radar sometimes, plus those environmental benefits may not get the recognition that's warranted. In the last legislative session, there was a bill, HB 1391, intended to help the public find their way through the various incentive programs that are here to help in our transition to a cleaner energy system. Unfortunately, that bill did not pass this time, but we are anticipating that it will be reintroduced next session, so stay tuned on that. We'll have show notes you can find at ccltacoma.org with a link to understanding this bill, as well as a link that describes incentives available to many of us via the Inflation Reduction Act, things like heat pumps, electric cars, improved weatherization, and so on. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under Programming. In the meantime, always live like the mountain is out, and take care now.